Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Nicholas Garfinkel. On June 14, 2021, the Supreme Court decided Terry v. United States. The issue before the court was whether pre-August 3, 2010 crack offenders sentenced under 21 U.S.C. 841b have a covered offense under Section 404 of the First Step Act. Justice Thomas delivered the opinion of the court in which Justices Roberts, Breyer, Alito, Kagan, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett joined. The decision affirmed the ruling of the Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, holding that crack offenders sentenced under 21 U.S.C. 841b do not have a covered offense under Section 404 of the First Step Act because a sentence reduction under the Act is available only if an offender's prior conviction of a crack cocaine offense triggered a mandatory minimum sentence. Justice Sotomayor filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. We are joined today by Vikrant P. Reddy, Senior Research Fellow at the Charles Koch Institute.
So the case starts really with an important part of American social history, which many of the people on the call will remember. And that's the crack epidemic that just ravaged the United States throughout the 1980s. If you were around back then, or if you've read enough about that period, you know that we had a major urban crisis of crime. A lot of it was connected to the drug trade. And there was a sense that much of it was connected in particular to crack. Crack as distinct from cocaine, by the way. The Congress got together and passed very, very serious criminal laws, prohibiting crack possession and crack use that were distinct in their harshness from the laws that we had against cocaine. In fact, the crack laws passed by the federal government were 100 times more severe than the cocaine laws. So to give you a sense of what that means, if you had been sentenced to 1 month in prison for a cocaine crime, a similar crack crime would have gotten you something like 8 years behind bars. I mean, it really was an extraordinary difference. And it was because we had a sense that crack was connected to crime and the urban crime epidemic in a way that cocaine simply wasn't. Now, as time went by, people's minds began to change about this. And there was a big movement to get Congress to equalize the crack and cocaine disparity in sentencing. And in fact, finally in 2010, Congress passed the Fair Sentencing Act that reduced these disparities from 100 to 1 down to 17 to 1. There was one exception, though, one big exception in this law, and that was that it was not made retroactive. So if you had been sentenced before that point, well, you were out of luck. For that reason, a major goal of people in the criminal justice reform community became making the Fair Sentencing Act retroactive. And for 8 years, the advocates were just relentlessly pushing for retroactivity of the Fair Sentencing Act. They finally got their wish in 2018 when Congress passed the First Step Act and Donald Trump signed it into law. Finally, the Fair Sentencing Act was made retroactive, and you had thousands of inmates who were in a position to ask the courts to recalculate their sentences because Congress had revised these crack sentences. Now, one of these thousands of inmates was a man named Taharik Terry. Terry was caught with 4 grams of crack back when he was 20 years old. I think this happened in Miami. And this is where things really start to get a little bit technical. So what happened was we'd have this this kind of previous, set of thresholds that would have triggered severe sentences back in 1986. And then we had a revised set of thresholds in 2010. So there are 3 different tiers You have the highest, most severe penalties. This is 10 years to life behind bars. You have kind of the medium tier, 5 years to 40 years. And then you have the lowest tier, anywhere from 0 to 20 years. High, medium, low. In 1986, you triggered the highest tier by having 50 grams or more of crack. That was revised in 2010, so it's not 50 grams and up, it's 280 grams up. The medium tier back in 1986 meant anywhere from 5 grams to 49 grams. Again, this is revised in 2010 under the Fair Sentencing Act, and now the medium tier is triggered by 28 grams to 279 grams. And then you have the lowest tier. In 1986, the lowest tier was 4 grams and below. The revisions in the Fair Sentencing Act in 2010 changed that 4 grams and below to nothing, technically. They didn't actually write anything. They didn't change 4 grams and below. But the interesting thing about it is, if you just stop and kind of think about it, is that if the medium tier was changed, so the lowest threshold went from 5 to 28, then obviously the lowest tier is now not below 5, but below 28. So instead of being 4 grams and below, it would be 27 grams and below. That's just logically what happened. The text was not directly modified, but kind of, you know, read the statute and reason it out, it obviously was modified. At least I think it was obviously modified, but that really is what this case turned on, was this question of what the word modified means and whether or not that lowest tier had been quote unquote modified. Because the way that the First Step Act was written was that the people who were able to have their sentences reviewed by courts at this point had to have their had to have been punished under a penalty statute that had been quote-unquote modified. And again, we're focused on whether or not the statute had been modified here. Now, to make things even more technical, remember I said that it's a matter of 4 grams and below changing to 27 grams and below. But the thing is that Mr. Terry was caught with 3.9 grams of crack. 3.9. And the reason that's relevant is that in 1986, he would have been in the lowest tier, 4 grams and below. And in 2010, he would have been in the lowest tier. And absolutely nothing would have changed about the kind of penalty he was subject to. Now, the broader penalty scheme changed, the broader statute changed. And it would be curious to think that Congress wanted to pass a law that that went, I guess to put it in these terms, a little bit easier on very serious drug kingpins, people like El Chapo, but somehow wanted to maintain the level of severity on mules and small-time people like Mr. Terry. That's kind of a curious outcome to reach. But if you stick to really the very strict text of what happened or what you see in front of you, that is the conclusion you'd have to reach. Now, one thing that I think is really interesting that I think is worth talking a bit about, is there are a whole bunch of amicus briefs filed in this case, but one amicus brief in particular that I want to direct everyone's attention to was filed by the four senators who are the lead authors of the First Step Act. And this is a bipartisan group of senators, Senator Durbin and Senator Booker from the left, but also Senator Grassley and great Federal Society stalwart Senator Lee on the right. These four senators, Durbin, Grassley, Booker, and Lee, they submitted an amicus brief explaining to the court, this is what we meant to do. We intended not just to go go easier, quote unquote, on kingpins and yet maintain very harsh levels of severity on mules. We wanted to revise crack sentences for everybody. Now, the fact that some people in a unique position like Mr. Terry were kind of not captured by the drafting is just an oversight on our part. And the court should go ahead and find that Mr. Terry, like everybody else, is in a position to have his sentence reviewed by a federal judge. These four senators were explaining their legislative intent. So the opinion came out, and the court decided 9-0. That's notable. It was a unanimous opinion. 9-0 against Mr. Terry. They said, look, we're looking at the sentencing scheme here. And as far as we can tell, you know, there's this argument about whether or not the sentences were modified, whether or not the broader sentencing scheme being modified counts as being, quote unquote, modified, or whether or not the immediate direct language that Mr. Terry was sentenced under is the subsection of the statute that needs to be modified. It's all highly technical. But what it ultimately comes down to for us is that Mr. Terry, had he been caught and prosecuted under the 1986 guidelines, would have been subject to the exact same penalty scheme that he would have been subject to under the 2010 guidelines. And for that reason, he is not in a position to have his sentence reviewed by a court at this point. Now, Justice Sotomayor wrote a concurring opinion. Concurring, by the way, not dissenting. She agreed on the logic here, a concurring opinion where she said, it would be worth Congress, if they really feel this strongly about it. We had four senators filing a brief. We obviously, Congress supports the broader goals of the First Step Act. You know, if they find that there was this kind of drafting oversight, they should go back and fix it. And in fact, there is, I think, some legislation pending right now. I forget who's carrying it in the Senate, looking at, you know, one of these fixes to the First Step Act so that people in Mr. Terry's position can get their previous convictions reviewed by a federal court. So this leaves us in a place now where, like I said, I'm thinking a little bit about why it would have been that so many people in the federal society, according to Dean, found this case so fascinating. And I think what it is that the court took a very strict kind of textualist interpretation of what they saw in front of them. And they did this even though you had four senators who literally drafted the language that was relevant here, and who literally drafted it just 2 years ago. They didn't draft it 20 years ago or 40 years ago. Drafted it just 2 years ago, something to be counted in months, explaining to the court what they meant. And the court nevertheless said, look, that's not how we do law. You can't just come in and explain what your legislative intent was and then have us ignore the words on the page. We're not going to do it this way. And if you messed up, then it's up to you to fix it. This was an attitude that was taken not just by the conservative justices. This was an attitude that was adopted by Justice Breyer, Justice Kagan, and Justice Sotomayor. Remember, because it was a unanimous opinion. I am absolutely certain that Justice Sotomayor would have preferred that Mr. Terry win this case. I even suspect that Justice Gorsuch, based on the kinds of decisions he's made about criminal law recently, he's exhibited a real libertarian streak during his time on the bench, that he would have preferred that Mr. Terry win this case. But they looked at it, they looked at the text, they looked at it strictly, and they just found that the law couldn't get them there. And I think that had this case come before the court 40 years ago, it would not have been unanimous. It's possible that Mr. Terry would have won. It certainly would not have been unanimous. And I think a big part of why Mr. Terry would have won, or why the case would not have gone unanimously, is that people would have taken that senator's brief, justice would have taken that senator's brief very, very seriously. They didn't do that this time. And I think that something like 90 to 95% of the credit for that move, or that, how should I put it, judicial attitude on the part of the justices, 90% of the credit goes to Antonin Scalia, who really led a revolution in the way that courts are supposed to think about legislative history and congressional intent, things of that matter. And I just think it's hard to understate the enormous influence that this man almost single-handedly had on the direction of American law, and therefore on the direction of American life. And that's why, even though obviously Justice Scalia is not in the court and had nothing to do with the decision in this case, I really feel like he served as an intellectual lodestar for all the justices, left and right, in this case. And there are so many cases where you can kind of feel Justice Scalia's presence and his interpretive guidance, and many cases, big and small. This was a small one, but it was one in which I think it's very clear that that the revolution that he led was a big part of why this case was decided the way it was. Moving forward, I'm not sure what's going to happen in Congress. I think it's likely that, you know, Congress obviously really wants to do something here. Like I said, it was bipartisan, that brief. It was Donald Trump who signed the First Step Act into law. I don't think it's necessarily something that should trigger a lot of, kind of partisan blowback. But it nevertheless can be difficult to get things through Congress these days, so who knows what's going to happen. But that's the long and short of what happened in Terry and what the Terry opinion was all about. It was a small case, but an interesting case. I guess I'll say one last thing, which is that if you read some of the articles and you read some of the quotes from the advocates who are involved in this case, they're just completely incredulous that the case was decided the way that it was, especially considering the presence of the senator's brief. But I think that that's a reflection of people not fully appreciating the direction that American law has gone in recent years, thanks to Justice Scalia. I, for what it's worth, had I been on the court, would have decided the other way. Maybe I'm a little bit eccentric, but I actually think that this argument about whether or not the relevant language was modified or not modified is very complicated and very vague and kind of difficult to parse. And in situations like that, I think you ought to rely on the rule of lenity, which says that in criminal cases, as everyone knows, is an interpretive canon that in criminal cases, when things are sort of vague and you're not sure whether or not you should find in a way that's beneficial to the defendant or to the government, you just kind of default to finding against the government and in favor of the individual. It's just an interpretive canon that preserves individual liberties. It's kind of a part of our Anglo-American heritage. That's how I would have decided the case. And in fact, a group that I work closely with, Americans for Prosperity, filed an amicus brief making that very argument. The court did not decide it that way. I'm a little disappointed, but I'm not shocked. And I understand the logic. And I guess I was a little surprised that so many of the advocates were incredulous and found it impossible to comprehend the logic. It is a decision which, although I may be a bit disappointed and may disagree with, I completely understand. And it does make a certain amount of sense.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.